So our next speaker is Donald Matheson. Donald Matheson is actually a professor in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch in New Zealand. His research interests include journalism in new media and communication ethics. He has recently co-authored the book Digital War Reporting in 2009 with Stuart Allen, and he co-edits the journal Ethical Space. And so the title of his presentation today is When the Photojournalist Returns, Exploring Reflexive Moments in Photojournalism. So, Donald.
Thank you very much, Christine. Thank you to Media at McGill, to McCord, to those who facilitated the visit, to the translators, actually. I think they should always be given a special mention. It's a skill that I am in absolute awe of, the ability to simultaneously translate. So, merci. When the photojournalist returns, see if I can do this. I'll come back to Susan Marcellus later in the presentation, but this for me kind of sums up where I want to go with the talk today. The practice of photojournalism as a moment, and the demand, the expectation, the pressure to return that particular photojournalists feel, and I think is connected to a wider cultural moment. So what I want to do is, in the paper, is explore the contemporary status of the documentary or news photograph of conflict or suffering. I want to suggest that there's increasingly a demand to reconnect the photograph with the lives and voices of those represented in them. To put this another way, for a photo to be iconic, and that's a word that's been mentioned today and also in yesterday's session, its power, I think, is maybe drifting a little bit away from its ability to sustain, if I can say the word, repeated contemplation within a culture, and thereby sum up a moment in time or a shared experience. And instead, I think there's a bit more power in its ability to sustain a story across time and to build connections between people in different places and times. So hold on to that. When it becomes unclear, that's where I'm trying to get to. And I've thought about this through an interest in photojournalists who return to the people and scenes of powerful photographs that they've taken. I don't want to make a strong claim that this is happening more often, but I do want to make a claim that it's becoming more meaningful, the act of return. When photojournalists revisit scenes of photos, I think we can see an ethical demand become apparent in a way that wasn't perhaps quite so apparent a decade or more ago. When they revisit, I think we can also at times see photojournalists working through those demands to an extent and finding ways to produce ethically rich representations of the experience of conflict. And I'll argue that this revisit is interesting because it's an emblematic of the kind of mutuality that Ariella Azule, who was just mentioned in the previous presentation, has called for. One of Azule's points is that the responsible use of images of others' distress requires a sense of co-presence with those people in the image, who immediately no longer become fixed within how the viewer chooses to see and no longer so distanceable, because the subject now in some way shares the viewer's space in the world. So the revisit that I'll use as emblematic of that forces that kind of co-presence upon the original photograph and on the photographer, revealing expectations of those in the photographs of what the image means for them. And it provides one route to think about how photojournalism might perhaps renew itself in the face of critiques that it distances, objectifies, colonizes, and so on. I'll begin with two historic, iconic images that bear witness to suffering. In both, the act of following up with the subject of the image brings into focus the way an image turns a person into a thing that can be made use of, to use Sontag's terms, appropriated by the photographer and the culture more generally. Then I'll explore some more contemporary instances in which photographers have revisited the subjects of powerful images. Here, the revisit often reveals a demand from subjects and a desire from photojournalists that viewing not drift into that kind of spectatorship that I think we'll see in these first couple of images. And then I'll discuss attempts by some photojournalists who are using the act of revisiting to bring a greater degree of mutuality, as in Susan Micellus, who was also mentioned by Sharon Slominski in the previous talk, will be mentioned there again. So these two photographs that I'll talk about, this one and that one, have attained significant cultural status, coming to stand in, at least in US representations, I think, for the suffering of the poor in the US during the Depression of the 30s and the plight of women in Afghanistan. The point that someone like Azoulay would make about these iconic images is that they're objects of public culture. They belong to the world of those who are looking at them, looking again, redistributing, participating as a citizen by looking at them. The subjects of these iconic images aren't really central to their meaning in that representative practice. The images become filled with our meanings of them. And that, of course, is obvious in Dorothea Lange's photo, which I'm sure you're all familiar with and with some of the story of. The picture called Migrant Mother, taken in 1936 in a pea picker's camp in California. Lange's photograph had a powerful effect, leading to aid being sent to the camp, and it soon became emblematic of the scientific attempts of the Resettlement Administration, which commissioned Lange at social reform through objective record of the social and economic disruption of the 30s. Lange didn't record her subject's name, as I think was a common practice, but did record that her husband was dead and that she told me that she'd been living on frozen vegetables from the surrounding fields and birds that the children had killed. She had just sold the tyres from her car to buy food. It was 1979 before the subject of those images was revisited by a journalist after she wrote a letter to the local paper expressing her unhappiness. Florence Owen Thompson said the description and the impact that the image had were erroneous. She'd been merely waiting in the rain at the camp while her husband and elder children walked to town to fix the car radiator. By the time aid arrived, Thompson and her family, who were not destitute, had driven off and were working elsewhere. So the follow-up 43 years later showed that the power of the photograph had been to capture something more generalised, something aestheticised, certainly not the particular circumstances of Florence Owens Thompson. Thompson complained that the image had been something of a curse throughout her life and had provided her no benefit. Now, what Lange was doing was probably not something we'd describe as unethical at the time. Her objective record of the rural poor, objective, I suppose we should stick in scare quotes, was part of a documentary social justice tradition going back to the surveys of London and New York slums and other antecedents like that. It didn't disregard its subject, but instead it assumed an alignment of Lange's understanding with the social fact. Lange, in fact, wrote later, "There she sat in the lean-to tent with her children huddled around her and seemed to know that my pictures might help her, and so she helped me. There was a sort of equality about it." To have returned and asked Thompson what equality she felt would have been to step outside that documentary tradition, and we should probably not be too critical. We can, I think, be more critical of National Geographic photographer Steve McCurry, who took this powerful image on the left, Afghan girl in 1985, a 12-year-old girl in a Pakistani refugee camp. He wondered about the girl, felt an urge to return, and did so with a National Geographic camera crew in the wake of the US invasion in 2002 to try to find her. And I think his revisit is remarkable for the way it managed to sustain that sense of an iconic image and an entirely unreflexive account of the act of photographing. The original image had won awards for McCurry and prompted comparisons with, in fact, Lange's Migrant Mother, and, according to the magazine, with the Mona Lisa. "Her eyes are sea green," wrote the magazine. "They are haunted and haunting, and in them you can read the tragedy of a land drained by war." When McCurry found Sharbat Gula, as she is called, he learned she hadn't known of the photograph of her. She hadn't been photographed since. Her burqa was removed, and she sat for another series of photographs. And once again, although she was interviewed, the magazine mostly spoke for her. "It is said of the Pashtun that they are only at peace when they are at war, and her eyes then and now burn with ferocity," wrote National Geographic. So the appropriation of this woman's image to tell a romanticised Western version of the experience of Afghans through 2 decades of war, and of course implicitly of America's invasion and liberation of them, was an instance of global imbalances of power to represent and to speak, and that of course is a common story. The return, though, by McCurry, accompanied by analysis back home from forensic teams, including a sculptor who reconstructed her face from the image as if she was a corpse, to a skeleton to have her face reconstructed, an expert on retina identification, is uncomfortable because its lack of sensitivity to those problems. The lack of any reflexivity about the power of representation or the nature of the one-sided relationship with Gula. That's not deny any philanthropic intent. The magazine set up a fund and partnered with aid agencies to help Afghan girls access education. But the lack of awareness of what photography and its publication meant to her, removing her burqa, the forensic examination of her face, suggests, as Dauphiné writes in an analysis of the Abu Ghraib images, the torture images that we saw before, is an erasure of both the photographer's role and of the subject's perspective. While McCurry returns, it's to answer his own questions about what had happened to her, not to revisit the story, to give her a voice. The second photograph is a separate moment, I think, captured by his camera. Gula remains an object throughout. As one scholar Whitlock puts it, Gula is liberated on Western terms, bearing witness to what the West wants to see. And it seems to me, and this is the claim that is pushing the boat out a wee bit here, it seems to me that that kind of appropriation is becoming more difficult as critics and the profession and audiences find it less justifiable, less meaningful. And perhaps that's particularly the case in places where Western journalists and Western political dominance are read as intertwined. Allen and Zelizer talk of a change in the rules of engagement since the early 2000s, in which the position of the photographer or photojournalist as neutral observer is becoming much harder to sustain. The journalist is becoming more visible as an actor. And one thing revisiting does quite clearly is to emphasise that visibility, to bring it to the surface. Let me give an example. In December 2011, Tarana Akhbari, a 10-year-old girl, was among family members taking part in a procession in Kabul celebrating the Shiite festival of Ashura. When a suicide bomber killed 70 people, Akhbari was left standing amidst the dead and wounded. AFP photographer Masood Husseini photographed her screaming, with her body rigid, covered in blood. The New York Times Lens blog describes the return 4 months later of AFP's chief Afghan photographer, Shah Marai, to speak to Akhbari, and that's what this image represents, the return. While Akhbari had been speechless, in a state of shock, at the first photographic moment, at the second, she was able to smile and talk about her wish to return to school and her desire to be a school teacher. Not only are she and her family given a voice, but when given one, there's an expectation, too, of some degree of mutuality articulated. The family knew that Tarana's image had been widely used, and the photograph had won an award, and they hoped they'd see some benefit. The news had been on local TV in Kabul, so they watched closely in case the image appeared on Tuesday morning. The news made them hopeful, Mr. Marai said. So far, the family had not received any aid from international organisations. The photograph, I think, you can see in that kind of a quote, isn't regarded just as a record of the event by the Akhbari family, but as a connection between them and AFP and those who had viewed the image and used the image, with some mutual obligations attached. On one level, the relationship sought here could be seen as economic. The 11-year-old girl's pain sold newspapers, won awards, and the family would like some return on that. But I think it's more fundamental than that, as is evident when we look at a few more instances of return or revisit photographs. Nick Danziger talking about a project in 2010 where he revisited people in Niger, he'd photographed 5 years earlier, describes their happy astonishment at seeing him again. Most people don't expect me to return, and when I do, they're astonished and often very emotional. So there's a latent connection there that's reactivated is clear in the response he gets to when he comes back to revisit the boy who was in the mining tunnel and speaks to him as he's married with his family. By contrast, Israeli photojournalist Eldad Rafaeli describes attempting to follow in McCurry's footsteps by re-photographing a young girl whose hostile, belligerent face staring straight at his camera had defined a moment of the Intifada in 1995. He described the second image as a complete failure and he didn't publish it, as was his attempt to talk to her. She felt only anger, seeing him for a second time as part of the Israeli world that had killed three members of her family. At both moments, the relationship was one of an Israeli looking down a barrel at a politicized, hostile Palestinian. In these kind of moments of return, whether they're happy revisits or not, there's a clear sense among those photographed that the original moment was one in which they were making their own sense of the image and of the photographer making sense of them. And once I began looking for these kinds of moments where powerful images were revisited, I found huge numbers of them. There's ARCO data taken back in 2012 by a BBC film crew to meet Qutbuddin Ansari, whose image here was a defining one of the Gujarat riots in 2002 that left 1,000 dead. While the presence of photographers, including data, might have saved Ansari's life, the revisit reveals a photograph also stole some of his life. In the documentary, there's a very uncomfortable reunion between the photographer and subject in which no sense of resolution is possible. Qutbuddin had found it very difficult to get any work and continued to be branded as the face of the violence 10 years earlier. Anja Niedringhaus took a photograph of a severely wounded soldier, US Marine, Bernice Britt, in a helicopter in Afghanistan in 2011, felt compelled to return to photograph him as he convalesced a year later in hospital, both coming to terms with the trauma herself, but also to draw attention to the psychological problems of recovery for wounded soldiers. While these revisits aren't new, and clearly the Florence Thompson story from 1979 shows that, I think there's a particular need being evident in these examples for journalists to search out those people, to attempt to reach some kind of completeness that's no longer there in the initial image, and are confronted again, of course, with fresh complexity. Interestingly, the revisit often seems to happen very soon after the initial image. James Blake Miller, the emotionally drained Marine who was photographed by Los Angeles Times' Luis Cinco during the US siege of Fallujah on 8 November 2004, became a minor celebrity within days, if celebrity is the right word. George Bush, in fact, offered to send him cigars and even bring him home, the price of celebrity. He was sought out again by Cinco within 4 days, I think Cinco writes, at his editor's request. His story since of post-traumatic stress disorder, separation from his family, joining of a motorbike club, has been, some of the coverage puts it in if you ride a motorbike, you must be off to rob a bank, in fairly negative terms. But it's been widely chronicled in the media, is the point there. I think the original image is increasingly, particularly when it's a powerful image, fitting into that category of the iconic, that the original image increasingly doesn't stand alone as a kind of iconic cultural object that people like Harriman and Lucatis describe in their book on iconic photographs, but accrues further meaning over time for all those involved. Often those meanings bring to the fore, of course, the problems of photographing others' distress, the one-sided nature of the relationship, the fixing of them in that moment, the disempowerment of them. Some critics see the return as an attempt by those in a position of privilege to assuage their guilt, attempt to contain the discordant interpretations of an image through a fresh image, to re-individualize something that's becoming politicized. That seems a wee bit too rigid an analysis for me, given the way the voices of those photographed intrude in many of the examples. I think it also fails to account for the explicit recognition of those problems by a number of photojournalists who express a desire to give others voice through returning to the scenes of photographs. A key good example there is Molly Bingham, who returned to Baghdad just months after having been imprisoned in Abu Ghraib prison herself. She was imprisoned by the Saddam Hussein regime and then returned shortly after the liberation, the what do we call these things, after Baghdad had been taken, with the goal of recording the images and voices of Iraqi women who'd been imprisoned there. I'm sorry, that's not the image I want. No, I'll have to read it to you, I didn't put it up. I told them, she wrote, I had wanted to do the story. She told her friends who said don't go back that I'd wanted to do the story because so much press had been focused on my colleagues and me during our detention, but that I knew full well we were not the story. They were. These women, who had been treated fiercely by the regime, years of their lives robbed from them, were the real story, and I was grateful for the opportunity to tell it. Another example of that kind of return is Susan Micellis, who returned to Nicaragua a number of times. In one instance, returning 15 years after taking celebrated and shocking images of the Sandinista revolution, making a documentary of that, Pictures from a Revolution, in which she recorded her search and discussions with the subjects of the photographs, such as the woman, sorry, whose name I don't have recorded in this image, giving them the, showing them the photographs and talking over the meaning for them of the photographs, as they interpret, talk of their pride at their role in the revolution, of the limited gains made, of the fragile attempts to move on from war, and so on. Another Micellis project, which I find fascinating, has involved gathering large numbers of images from displaced Kurds of their former hometowns and ways of life as a form of shared memory. She makes explicit, as I was saying in as she says in the epigraph for this paper, she makes explicit one of the themes running through these contemporary revisit photographs of a sense of incompleteness, a demand or a desire to connect the images back with the people in them and their ongoing stories. We take pictures away, I'll come to that in a sec, we take pictures away and we don't bring them back. That became a central quest for me, relinking, revisiting the repatriation of work. Now, these moments of revisit raise the same issues about the relationship, similar issues, I suppose I should say, about the relationship set up in an image of war or distress that a number of photojournalists and critics have also begun reflecting on. The Israeli photojournalist Ariella Azoulay calls that relationship the civil contract of photography. And she makes an ethical statement about what responsible spectatorship of conflict photography entails, which I think is useful for thinking about our subject here. As many others have done, she notes the rudeness or the violence of any photograph that, of course, fixes someone at a moment, gives the status of something, some more generalizable reality to that moment. The photograph person is caught. I think that's also language that Susan Sontag has used. Yet she calls, Azoulay calls the photograph also a meeting between the photographer and the person photographed, traces of which are left on the film. In emphasising the people involved, she's along with critics like Mark Furstenau, who I think studied here at McGill, is that right? Possibly. Possibly that's a comment on his study, I don't know. Or Susie Linfield diverges from the scholarly tradition of seeing a photograph as losing touch with its referent. In fact, Azoulay explicitly rejects from the beginning of her argument, both the artistic discourse on photography and post-structuralist theories of the image, and she cites people like Barthes, Baudrillard, and Sontag. We should not, she argues, unburden ourselves so easily of the responsibility to look back into the faces of those who are in those photographs. She calls on viewers, then, to accept a moral responsibility to see the real person in the image of atrocity or conflict. When the assumption is, she writes, that they are still present there at the time I'm watching them, my viewing of these photographs is less susceptible to becoming immoral. It's in then recognising our temporal co-presence with the photographed body. Photography critic Marta Zarzika sums this up in a review quite nicely. If we assume that photographed people have not just been there once, but are still there at the time we're watching them, we can restore the identity, accountability, temporality previously denied to oppressed groups. And Azoulay talks of a civic political space that's opened up when people encounter each other through photographs. the notion of some contractual obligation is certainly quite useful in describing some of the revisiting that I was just talking about. What Azzulli adds to that is a conviction that this co-presence can't just be seen as interpersonal, but is also deeply political. An image she uses to illustrate her argument is a Palestinian shopkeeper in Hebron holding up a padlock after the occupation of the West Bank in 1982. On encountering the photographer, Anat Saragusti, Azzulli writes, "The merchant faced the camera and demonstrated directly for all to witness evidence of the damage caused to him. The lock of his store forced open and destroyed by Israeli paratroopers sent in to break the strike." The man in the photograph is not borne witness to. He's himself bearing witness, addressing us directly and using the opportunity to communicate a message, says Azzulli. So to her, he's entering knowingly into a civic space of the gaze, allowing himself to be photographed as a way of gaining some small measure of power, perhaps, back in the face of physical force. Moreover, Azzulli argues the three parties to that space, the photographer, the subject, and the viewer, come into this image around the claim that this situation they're witnessing is intolerable. So it's this implicit contract of regard for others who share the space with us that's present too in things like the Akbari case. If the photographer Masoud Husseini cried as he took the image of Tarana Akbari, as he said he did, if audiences were shocked, if award juries were deeply affected by the image, what does that commit them to then? These and other questions become starkly visible, I think, when photographers allow themselves to re-enter that space of mutual seeing with their subjects and their audiences by revisiting former photographs. I've suggested above that this visibility might reflect a cultural change, a waning of a kind of National Geographic style ability to separate the world of the magazine and the world that records. Another way to put it is that the photograph today is less easily divorced, perhaps, from the reality of those involved in it. It resists that particular aesthetic. The ideal documentary photograph, in that view, is no longer one that captures something perfectly, you know, the decisive moment of Cartier-Bresson. It's one that is embedded in a web of relationships between people. Susie Linfield makes this kind of point in her recent book. She passionately defends the power of photographs of distressing subjects to have a positive impact and begins that argument from this position. She calls on viewers to connect photographs back to the world outside their frames, to give them their life back, to access the full meaning of them. I want to turn in my last 10 minutes or so to what some of the drivers of that change in the status of photograph of conflict might be, in a bid to try to connect particularly with the title of this symposium. What's going on here? What's the broader context? In our contemporary world, obviously, the subject is more likely to talk back these days. This is true in technological terms, of course, as the former monopolies of mass communication media have dissolved into a multiplicities of media products and platforms, including some that are highly interactive and social. Much has changed in a digital world, and we've been talking about that a wee bit today already, whether we call that cultural convergence or participatory media or something else. That change, I think, is also inseparable, and it's important to look more broadly to some wider cultural shifts. As noted above, the rules of engagement for journalism have changed. It's widely regarded as less capable of maintaining neutrality or distance from what it records. Those photographed are more likely to be aware of the politics of the image. The Akbari family were there turning on the TV to see if the image of their daughter had appeared yet on television. And they wish to have some role in how they're framed. Political philosophy, of course, is also focused on links between communication and those key terms of participation, civil rights, self-determination. So the hegemony, if you want to, we can call it that, of the authoritative Western act of photographing others is clearly far from uncontested these days. That, though, isn't to make the photograph in these contexts less meaningful. The examples above, I think, suggest that powerful images are surrounded by layers of interpretation, stories, and further images. The conditions for photojournalism then, as Gilles Perez, who was also mentioned already today, the conditions for photojournalism are certainly different. He writes, we're entering an age in which visual language is defined by a dialogue between photographers and audiences. This means not just the democratic posting of images, but the democratic interpretation of images. In the melee of images circulating in media of various kinds, a photojournalist loses then any privileged place. But for Perez, that makes the photograph still highly powerful, only less univocal. There is no longer a voice of authority with univocal images created from above. His ideal photojournalist becomes, and the ideal he sets for himself is there to be more humble, listening to the subjects that he photographs. The drive then to revisit shows in particular that photographs have got less authority in contemporary culture as independent accounts of events. They increasingly gain their meaning from being part of the social world around them. The meaning around them is valued more highly as central to their meaning, is perhaps another way of putting it. Let me explain. They've got a provenance. Part of the meaning of the image is where it came from, who endorsed it, how it was gathered, how it's gathered interpretations in its journey. And I'm sorry to return to the Abu Ghraib images, but it's a classic example. Private images, which were originally produced to entertain US guards and to further torture and humiliate prisoners, were then sent on to a certain military subcommunity, then leaked more widely, then published in national US media, then used in huge number of other forms, circulated online and elsewhere. They've got no ultimate meaning, but they are contested and reworked and accrue further meanings as they are distributed. Indeed, I think some of the most iconic images of contemporary politics, and this again is an image we've seen in another form once already today, some of the most iconic images are those whose amateur quality attests to the context in which they were taken. So the image of the young Iranian... Now, I'm not sure if I have got her name right because there was confusion over her name. Neda Agasultan is what I have written down, but others may correct me if I've followed the erroneous initial naming of her. The image of her dying in a Tehran gutter in 2009 drew part of its meaning, of course, from being distributed by activists and then internationally as a conscious political act. This wasn't, as Peter was also saying, a journalistic recording of a decisive moment, but it's a piece of evidence condemning the authoritarian Iranian state that was passed from computer to computer with that explicit intent. The revisiting of photographs, whether it's Micellus's conscious bringing together of photographs that can reconnect Kurds with their occupied lands, or Ansari's discomfort over the photograph that defined him as an object of the Gujarat riots, makes sense, I think, in these terms as images being political objects which do much more than record. The photograph, in this sense, accrues meaning from the political talk around it, and the revisit makes sense as part of that accrual, further accrual of meaning. These visits also, of course, attest to a world that's smaller. Photographs that remain objects brought back from afar, like McCurry's image of Shabat Gula, fail, I think, in some sense in this world. The rapid circulation of images around the globe, the ease of travel, shared global media, however imbalanced and patchy those things are, support an increasingly common claim to a global polity of some kind, and certainly a moral claim that we should inhabit some kind of global polity. Furstenau, who I mentioned before, writes, we've been granted an unprecedented degree of knowledge about the world, which hasn't determined a complex global network of responsibility and obligation. Whether we call that cosmopolitanism or global civil society, the cultural context of photojournalism makes a univocal, distanced photograph less adequate as an account in that political and moral context. The photojournalist's responsibility, then, includes that of making each of us present to each other in some way. And the revisit is again one way to meet that obligation to connect as well as represent. Now, none of this is to say that there's any inevitability to photography making sense in these terms. Campbell, in a piece on Darfur, writes that few photographs from that humanitarian emergency, including those by James Nachtwey, were able to escape the tendency towards stereotypes of victims, refugees, the pitiful. The photographer struggles all the time to escape what Campbell calls a culturally determined sense of an image's power prior to their encounter with their subject. What I'm instead suggesting is that an emerging set of ethical expectations about how the photojournalist records powerful images of conflict or suffering, and some emerging practices which work within that set of expectation. Mycelis expresses this as the closing of a circle. And within these expectations, the moral act of bearing witness to suffering is maybe only the beginning of meaningful engagement with the experiences of conflict. In fact, bearing witness appears rather than a kind of one-way relationship, too focused on the moral community of watchers and not enough on the voice of the subject or on any other form of mutuality. Ethically, I think it begins to appear a wee bit incomplete, not just because of questions or consent or control in those images, but because, I'll use Sontag again, to participate in another person's mortality, vulnerability, mutability, only for that moment. That's not to regard all revisits as ethical by any means, but as perhaps being capable of something richer that meets some of those expectations and speak to a current cultural context. I'll end with one further photojournalist reflection. Wendy Watrous, take us away from that image. Wendy Watrous, frustrated at the limited public impact of her record of the effects of Agent Orange on survivors of the Vietnam War, writes that taking photographs, telling a story with them, is only the first step. Even in the best of times, even when highly recognised within the field itself, our images are only tools themselves, not an end in themselves. To practice photojournalism in a way that brings meaning and change requires photograph to think past the boundaries of this profession. And she's worked herself with former US combatants, NGOs, activists, other ways of using images than going for the front page of news media, newspapers, things like travelling exhibitions, online platforms. Now, what's at stake here is clearly some sense of journalistic separation, of being only a witness. And it's probably relevant that nearly all the figures that I've spoke about here, from Danziger to Azule to Mycelis, have no interest in that claim, that kind of a claim to distance. So just to end in one sentence, if I can, photojournalism's emerging power is maybe less in the instant of the front page news image than in ongoing commitments to provide some co-presence across the distances of the contemporary world. Thanks.
Do we have any questions?
Thank you very much for your talk. I was wondering, in light of your conclusion, but it's not just a conclusion, because in a way you made your argumentation quite coherent with regards to that conclusion, is that when we speak about the iconic, for example, I'm not sure if I'm using the right word in this sense, but the iconic in a way does, I would say, correspond to a certain form of an arrest, you know, a fixation, the iconic, right? And brings us closer to this sort of, punctum, or does it, I don't know, I'm not sure, but we could argue that it doesn't really favor that much of this type of circulation that you're speaking about. I mean, of course it can physically circulate, but the sense of the mobility, let's say, or the shift in meaning, right, that that is made possible by these other images. And I was wondering, in a way, and if we speak about, again, about the photographic situation that Sharon was speaking about, when you start to disclose the many different spectators of the image, its different context of presentation, that's where we can start to be aware of the photographic situation. It's a way where you kind of go beyond the iconic, the sort of freeze where you just see the image and that's it. It seems to be full in and by itself, sort of complete, right? And so so it seems to me that perhaps we have these type of images that sort of circulate, sometimes they sort of disappear also, and but then you have those, these sort of iconic that frees something, that frees in a way, and perhaps sort of prevents that type of photographic situation to sort of unravel, or that sort of suspends also this this shift in meaning that an image can actually acquire.
Mm. Oh, there's so much in that. I'm not, I was going to say not much, but I should probably say not at all a scholar of iconography in the religious sense. But my guess there, and maybe I should go off and read something before I answer the question then, is that the icon in a religious sense is seen as an object that connects you to the saint or to the sacred. And so it's and the extent to which spiritual value and spiritual presence, I should say, not value, spiritual presence is invested in that object, I think is probably central to the to some meanings of icon. So I don't think an icon has to be seen as an object. It can be read in other ways. But the fixing of meaning in an icon, when I think of, I mean, let's go back one slide. The image there of a woman who's was killed in protests in Iran has been used in so many ways. It's made its way onto posters. Sorry, it's a distressing image. I won't stay on it very long. It's been used in many different ways. It's been contested what the meaning was. As I was saying before, the identity of the person in it is contested. Who took the photo, what the context was, and there's been a huge amount of talk that surrounded it. And so it's it grows in importance the more talk there is around it, the more contested it is. That's kind of where I'm going with. Does that connect at all with what you're saying?
Yeah, I think, maybe the use of the icon, the iconic, wasn't a really good one, in the sense that it seems to me that there are some images that reify. There are, for example, for me, the image of the falling man. It just, at one point, it just seizes, it just becomes reified. It just becomes sort of used, even a kind of, used for... It doesn't have that sort of a porosity of meaning. It just at one point becomes more of an object. It becomes more empty, as much as as it circulates. It just becomes that, and that sort of mobility of meaning ceases, or even context ceases to be operational. So maybe it's not the iconic, but there are some images that become more reified, more commodified.
Yes, it's a bit like the Andy Warhol images, that you get multiple reproduction which begins to drain it of particularity. That kind of, I think the going back to an image, and whether it's a photojournalist going back to speak to individuals, or whether it's that process of an image becoming iconic because it's reproduced frequently, you can go two directions, and you can go towards the formal value of that image, that it's a shared cultural object which encourages contemplation and becomes significant in a particular culture. Or you could go the other way, that it's the more it's reproduced, the more it's seen, the more it's the more it's revisited, the more it gains multiplicities of meaning. So I suppose what I'm trying to say is, I think that second direction is becoming more common, and is perhaps becoming not only significant for particular photojournalists who are trying to engage with problems, criticisms of their craft, but also becoming culturally meaningful, powerful, whatever you want to say. How I defend that kind of a claim, it's hard to.
Works just in the opposite sense, because most photographers do not revisit their images. Of the ones who did, there's no record that they do it to other pictures. They only do it on certain ones. Similarly, there's no evidence to suggest that the viewer has suddenly become more activated in whatever the event was. Instead, it would seem to act as a kind of one-time life opportunity to say that, okay, we're tuned in now into this particular thing, and so we don't have to do anything else because we've already expressed our, whatever it is, our emotional quality or our intellectual quality by attaching it to this particular image, so our work is done. So it seems to me that rather than argue that these images have made photojournalism have more of an engaged, an ongoing presence, they do just the reverse. They, in effect, remove the need to have continued revisiting by either the viewer or the journalist. They become reified. They become just simple, single incidents, events. I'm a little puzzled by your argument, in a sense. I mean, I'm only suggesting this because I'm a little puzzled. I'm not sure about the argument.
Yeah, and I'm... Sorry. And I'm trying to think of a way to respond, because I thought I did have some evidence for the argument. If we go to that... why then would the AFP chief photographer go back to... The girl who was a survivor of the suicide bombing. I don't think that's an aberration. In fact, I could have listed dozens more instances of photojournalists doing that, and I can also cite lots of instances of images which have been iconic, which have now in more recent years been returned to. The image from Kent State, for example, that Peter showed us, is that right? Yeah, this morning, this afternoon. That was just a short number of years ago, the subject of a story of bringing those people together again. So I think there's a phenomenon here which I think needs to be thought through. I don't accept that the photographs simply reify and that there is these moments of return are not meaningful in any way, or are simply second moments. No. Yeah, sorry, that was not right.
They have a particular meaning, but I'm arguing that their meaning is very particularized. It isn't general.
Mm.
My quarrel with you, in a sense, is the general argument you're making about photojournalism has demonstrated that photo images have an ongoing presence. And I'm suggesting that using certain iconic images to suggest this would seem to be counterproductive, would seem to suggest just the very opposite of what you're trying to suggest.
Yeah, I could see where you're going. Someone like, I find Azule very, very useful in thinking through this, because she was arguing that to regard images, to allow them to be fixed, and not to look for further meaning to them, not to particular to look for what they mean for the person in those images, to hear the person in the image, or to see the person in the image looking back and to hear their voice is unethical. So I think if the point is that the more powerful an image is, the more it reifies, then I suppose the reply is the more it accentuates that moral problem, and so therefore becomes more of a focus of this kind of concern about finding further meaning, seeking to connect with the subjects.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We have time for a couple of more questions, if anyone has. Okay, well, thank you very much, Donald. And we'll start up.